The function requires a number of inputs. One of these is a date. Azure is a system for generating one-time pads that change every day, and circumstantial evidence from the room of the dead Abacus slaves tells them that, at the moment of their death, they were working on the one-time pad for 6 August 1945, which is 4 months in the future. Waterhouse writes it down in the European style, day of the month first, then month, as 06-08-1945. Then lops off the leading zero to get 6,081,945. A pure quantity, an integer, unmarred by decimal point, rounding error, or any of the other compromises so abhorrent to number theorists. He uses this as one of the inputs to the zeta function. The zeta function requires a few other inputs, too, which the person who designed this cryptosystem, presumably Rudy, was at liberty to choose. Surmising which inputs Rudy used has occupied much of Waterhouse's thoughts in the last week. He puts in the numbers he has guessed anyway, which is a matter of converting them to binary notation, and then physically incarnating those ones and zeros on a neat row of stainless steel toggle switches, down for zero, up for one. Finally, he puts on his artilleryman's ear protectors and lets the digital computer howl through the calculation. The room gets much hotter. A vacuum tube burns out, and then another one. Waterhouse replaces them. That's easy, because Lieutenant Colonel Comstock has made a basically infinite supply of tubes available to him. Quite a remarkable feat during wartime. The filaments of all those massed tubes glow redly and shine palpable radiant heat across the room. The smell of hot oil rises from the louvers on the ETC card machines. The stack of blank cards in the input hopper shortens mysteriously as they vanish into the machine. Cards skitter into the output bin. Waterhouse pulls them out and looks at them. His heart is pounding very hard. It's quiet again. The cards have numbers on them, nothing more. They just happen to be exactly the same numbers that were frozen on certain abaci down in the room of the computer slaves. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse has just demolished another enemy cryptosystem. Azure Pufferfish may now be mounted like a stuffed head on the wall of the basement. And indeed, looking at those numbers, he feels the same kind of letdown that a big game hunter must feel when he stalked some legendary beast halfway across Africa and finally brought it down with a slug through the heart, walked up to the corpse, and discovered that after all, it's just a big, messy pile of meat. It's dirty, and it's got flies on it. Is that all there is to it? Why didn't he solve this thing a long time ago? All of the old Azure Pufferfish intercepts can be decrypted now. He'll have to read them, and they will turn out to be the usual numb mutterings of giant bureaucracies trying to take over the world. He doesn't frankly care anymore. He just wants to get the hell out of here and get married, play the organ and program his digital computer, and hopefully get someone to pay him a salary to do one or the other. But Mary's in Brisbane, and the war's not over yet. We haven't even gotten around to invading Nippon, for Christ's sakes, and conquering the place is going to take forever with all those plucky Nipponese women and children drilling on soccer fields with pointed bamboo staves, and it's probably going to be something like 1955 before he can even get discharged from the military. The war is not over yet, and as long as it goes on, they will need him to stay down here in the basement doing more of what he just did. Arethusa. He still hasn't broken Arethusa. Now that's a cryptosystem. He's too tired. He can't break Arethusa just now. What he really needs is someone to talk to. Not about anything in particular, just to talk. But there's only half a dozen people on the planet he can really talk to, and none of them is in the Philippines. Fortunately, there are long copper wires running underneath the oceans which made geographical location irrelevant, as long as you have the right clearance. Waterhouse does. He gets up and leaves the basement and goes to have a chat with his friend Alan. Akihabara. As Randy's plane banks into Narita, a low stratum of cloud screens the countryside like a silk veil. It must be Nippon. The only two colors are the orange of the earth-moving equipment and the green of the earth that has not yet been moved. Other than that, everything is grayscale. Gray parking lots divided into rectangles by white lines. The rectangles occupied with black, white, or gray cars, fading off into silvery fog beneath a sky the color of aviation alloy. Nippon is soothing. A good destination for a man who has just been rousted from his jail cell, hauled up before a judge, tongue-lashed, driven to the airport, and expelled from the Philippines. The Nippanese look more American than Americans. Middle-class prosperity is lapidary. The flow of cash rounds and smooths a person like water does riverbed stones. The goal of all such persons seems to be to make themselves cuddly and non-threatening. The girls, in particular, are unbearably precious, although perhaps Randy just thinks so because of that troublesome neurological hookup between his brain and little man Tate. The old folks, instead of looking weathered and formidable, tend to wear sneakers and baseball caps. Black leather, studs, and handcuffs as accessories are the marks of the powerless lower classes, the people who tend to end up in the pokey in Manila, and not of the persons who actually dominate the world and crush everything in their path.
The bus is leaving in 5 minutes.
Nothing happens in Nippon without a perky, breathy woman's voice giving you a chance to brace yourself. It is safe to say that this is not true of the Philippines. Randy thinks about taking a bus into Tokyo until he comes to his senses and remembers that he's carrying around in his head the precise coordinates of a mine that probably contains not less than 1,000 tons of gold. He hails a taxi. On the way into town, he passes by a road accident. A tanker truck has crossed the white line and flipped over on the shoulder. But in Nippon, even traffic accidents have the grave precision of ancient Shinto rituals. White-gloved cops direct traffic. Moon-suited rescue workers descend from spotless emergency vans. The taxi passes beneath Tokyo Bay through a tunnel that was built 3 decades ago by Goto Engineering. Randy ends up in a big old hotel. Old meaning that the physical structure was constructed during the 50s, when Americans competed with Soviets to build the most brutalistic space-age buildings out of the most depressing industrial materials. And indeed, one can easily imagine Ike and Mamie pulling up to the front door in a 5-ton Lincoln Continental. Of course, the interior has been gutted and redone more frequently than many hotels steam clean their carpets, and so everything is perfect. Randy has a strong impulse to lie in bed like a sack of shit, but he is tired of being confined. And there are many people he could talk to on the phone, but he is supremely paranoid about telephone conversations now. Any talking that he might do would have to be censored. Talking openly and freely is a pleasure. Talking carefully is work. And Randy doesn't feel like work. He calls his parents to tell them everything's fine, calls Chester to thank him. Then he takes his laptop downstairs and sits in the middle of the hotel's lobby, which is ostentatiously vast by Tokyo standards. The value of the land beneath the lobby alone probably exceeds that of Cape Cod. No one can even get near him with a VanEck antenna here. And even if they do, there will be plenty of interference from the nearby computers of the concierge desk. He starts ordering drinks, alternating between brutally cold pale Nippanese beer and hot tea, and writes a memo explaining more or less what he has spent the last month accomplishing. He writes it very slowly because his hands are practically immobilized now by carpal tunnel syndrome, and any motion that even faintly resembles typing causes him a lot of pain. He ends up catching a pencil from the concierge and then using its eraser to punch the keys one at a time. The memo begins with the word carpal, which is a little code that they have developed to explain why the following text seems unnaturally terse and devoid of capital letters. He's barely got that tapped out when he's approached by a devastatingly cute and fluttery young thing in a kimono who tells him that there is a staff of typists on call in the business center to help him with this, should he desire it. Randy declines as politely as he knows how, which is probably not politely enough. Kimono girl backs away in tiny steps, bowing and uttering truncated subvocal heis. Randy goes back to work with the pencil eraser. He explains, as briefly and clearly as he can, what he's been doing and what he thinks is going on with General Wing and Enoch Root. He leaves the subject of what the fuck's going on with the dentist open for speculation. When he's done, he encrypts it and then goes up to his room to email it. He can't get over the cleanliness of his lodgings. The sheets appear to have been tightened around the mattress with turnbuckles, then dipped in starch. This is the first time in over a month that he hasn't had the warm, wet reek of sewer gas climbing up his nostrils and the ammoniacal tang of evaporating urine stinging his eyes. Somewhere in Nippon, a man in a clean white coverall stands in a room with a fat, hose-fed gun vomiting freshly chopped glass fibers slathered with polyester resin onto a curvaceous form. Peeled off the form, the result is bathrooms like this one. A single topological surface, pierced in at most two or three places by drains and nozzles. While Randy's emailing his memo, he lets hot water run into the largest and smoothest depression in the bathroom surface. Then he takes off his clothes and climbs into it. He never takes baths, but between the foulness that seems infused into his flesh now and the throbbing of his hunk of burning love, there was never a better time. The last few days were the worst. When Randy finished his project and displayed the bogus results on the screen, he expected that the cell door would swing open immediately. That he'd walk out onto the streets of Manila and that, just for extra bonus points, Amy might even be waiting for him. But nothing at all happened for a whole day, and then Attorney Alejandro came to tell him that a deal might be possible, but that it would take some work. And then it turned out that the deal was actually a pretty bad one. Randy was not going to be exonerated as such. He was going to be deported from the country under orders not to come back. Attorney Alejandro never claimed that this was a particularly good deal, but something in his manner made it clear that there was no point griping about it. The decision had been made at levels that were not accessible. He could very easily take care of the hunk of burning love problem now that he has privacy, but astonishes himself by electing not to. This may be perverse. He's not sure. The last month and a half of total celibacy, relieved only by nocturnal emissions at roughly 2-week intervals, has definitely got him in a mental space he has never been to before, or come near, or even heard about. When he was in jail, he had to develop a fierce mental discipline in order not to be distracted by thoughts of sex. He got alarmingly good at it after a while. It's a highly unnatural approach to the mind-body problem, pretty much the antithesis of every 60s and 70s-tinged philosophy that he ever imbibed from his baby boomer elders. It is the kind of thing he associates with scary hard-asses, Spartans, Victorians, and mid-20th century military heroes. It has turned Randy into something of a hard-ass in his approach to hacking and, meanwhile, he suspects, it has got him into a much more intense and passionate headspace than he's ever known when it comes to matters of the heart. He won't really know that until he comes face to face with Amy, which looks like it's going to be a while since he's just been kicked out of the country where she lives and works. Just as an experiment, he decides he's going to keep his hands off of himself for now. If it makes him a little tense and volatile compared to his pathologically mellow West Coast self, then so be it. One nice thing about being in Asia is that tense, volatile people blend right in. It's not like anyone ever died from being horny. So he arises from the bath, unsullied, and wraps himself in a vestal white robe. His cell in Manila did not have a mirror. He knew he was probably losing weight, but not until he climbs out of the bath and gives himself a look in the mirror does he realize just how much. For the first time since he was an adolescent, he has a waist, which makes a white bathrobe into a quasi-practical garment. He's scarcely recognizable. Before the beginning of this, the third business foray, he kind of assumed that going into his mid-30s, he had figured out who he was and that he'd keep being the way he was forever, except with a gradually decaying body and gradually increasing net worth. He didn't imagine it was possible to change so much, and he wonders where it's going to end. But this is nothing more than an anomalous moment of reflection. He He shakes it off and gets back to his life. The Nipponese have, and have always had, a marvelous skill with graphic images. This is clear in their manga and their anime, but reaches its fullest expressive flower in safety ideograms. Licking red flames, buildings splitting and falling as the jagged earth parts beneath them, a fleeing figure silhouetted in a doorway, suspended in the stroboscopic flash of a detonation. The written materials accompanying these images are, of course, not understandable to Randy, and so there is nothing for his rational mind to work on. The terrifying ideograms blaze, fragmentary nightmare images popping up on walls and in the drawers of his room's desk, whenever he lets his guard down for a moment. What he can read is not exactly soothing. Trying to sleep, he lies in bed, mentally checking the locations of his bedside emergency flashlight and the pair of freebie slippers, much too small, thoughtfully left there so that he can sprint out of the burning and collapsing hotel without cutting his feet to sashimi when the next magnitude 8.0 tumbler shivers the windows out of their frames. He stares up at the ceiling, which is fraught with safety equipment, whose LEDs form a glowing red constellation. A crouching figure known to the ancient Greeks as Ganymede, the anally receptive cupbearer, and the Nipponese as Hideo, the plucky disaster relief worker, bending over to probe a pile of jagged concrete slabs for anything that's squishy. All of this leaves him in a state of free-floating terror. He gets up at 5 in the morning, grabs 2 capsules of Japanese snack from his minibar, and leaves the hotel, following one of the 2 emergency exit routes that he has memorized. He starts wandering, thinking it would be fun to get lost. Getting lost happens in about 30 seconds. He should have brought his GPS and marked the latitude and longitude of the hotel. The latitude and longitude of Golgotha are expressed in the Arethusa intercept in degrees, minutes, seconds, and tenths of a second of latitude and longitude. A minute is a nautical mile. A second is about 100 feet. In the seconds figure, the Golgotha numbers have 1 digit after the decimal point, which implies a precision of 10 feet. GPS receivers can give you that kind of precision. Randy's not so sure about the sextants that the Nipponese surveyors presumably used during the war. Before he left, he wrote the numbers down on a scrap of paper, but he rounded off the seconds part and just expressed it in the form of XX degrees and 20.5 minutes, implying a precision of a couple of 1,000 feet. Then he invented 3 other locations in the same general vicinity, but miles away, and put them all into a list, with the real location being number 2 on the list. Above it, he wrote, "Who owns these parcels of land?" Or in crypto-speak, W-H-O-O-W, space, N-S-T-H-E, space, S-E-P-A-R, etc. And then spent an almost unbelievably tedious evening synchronizing the 2 decks of cards and encrypting the entire message with the solitaire algorithm. He gave the ciphertext and the unused deck to Enoch Root, then swiped the plain text through some of the leftover grease in his dinner tray and left it by the open drain. Within the hour, a rat had come around and eaten it. He wanders all day. At first, it is just bleak and depressing, and he thinks he's going to give up very soon. But then he gets into the spirit of it and learns how to eat. You approach gentlemen on street corners selling little fried octopus balls and make Neolithic grunting noises and proffer yen until you discover food in your hands and then you eat it. Through some kind of nerdish homing instinct, he finds Akihabara, the electronics district, and spends a while wandering through stores looking at all of the consumer electronics that will go on sale in the States a year from now. That's where he is when his GSM telephone rings.
Hello?
It's me. I'm standing behind a fat yellow line.
Which airport?
Narita.
Delighted to hear it. Tell your driver to take you to Mr. Donut in Akihabara.
Randy's there an hour later, flipping through a phone book-sized manga epic, when Abby walks in. The unspoken Randy-Abby greeting protocol dictates that they hug each other at this point, so they do, somewhat to the astonishment of their fellow donut eaters, who usually make do with bowing. The Mr. Donut is a three-level affair jammed into a sliver of real estate with approximately the same footprint as a spiral staircase and is quite crowded with people who took compulsory English in their excellent and highly competitive schools. Besides, Randy broadcast the time and location of the meeting over a radio an hour ago. So as long as they are there, Randy and Abby talk about relatively innocuous things. Then they go out for a stroll. Abby knows his way around this neighborhood. He leads Randy through a doorway and into Nerdvana.
Many people, Abby explains,
do not know that the word normally spelled and pronounced Nirvana can be more accurately transliterated Nerdvana, or arguably Nerdvana. This is Nerdvana, the nucleus around which Akihabara accreted. This is where the Pasokan Otaku go to get the stuff they need.
Pasokan Otaku?
Personal computer nerds, Abby says. But as in so many other things, the Nipponese take it to an extreme that we barely imagine.
The place is laid out precisely like an Asian food market. It is a maze of narrow aisles wandering among tiny stalls barely larger than phone booths, where merchants have their wares laid out for inspection. The first thing they see is a wire stall, at least 100 reels of different types and gauges of wire in gaily hued plastic insulation.
How apropos, Abby says, admiring the display. We need to talk about wires.
It need not be stated that this place is a great venue for a conversation. The paths between the stalls are so narrow that they have to walk in single file. No one can follow them or get close to them here without being ridiculously blatant. An array of soldering irons bristles wickedly, giving one stall the look of a martial arts store. Coffee can-sized potentiometers are stacked in pyramids.
Tell me about wires, Randy says. I don't need to tell you how dependent we are on submarine cables, Abby says.
We meaning the crypt or society in general?
Both. Obviously, the crypt can't even function without communications linkages to the outside world, but the internet and everything else are just as dependent on cables.
A Pasokan Otaku in a trench coat, holding a plastic bowl as shopping cart, hunches over a display of gleaming copper toroidal coils that look to have been hand-polished by the owner. Finger-sized halogen spotlights mounted on an overhead rack emphasize their geometric perfection.
So, cables are vulnerable.
They wander past a stall that specializes in banana plugs, with a sideline in alligator clips, arranged in colorful rosettes around discs of cardboard.
Those cables used to be owned by PTAs, which were basically just branches of governments. Hence, they pretty much did what governments told them to. But the new cables going in today are owned and controlled by corporations beholden to no one except their investors. Put certain governments in a position they don't like very much.
Okay,
Randy says.
They used to have ultimate control over how information flowed between countries and that they ran the PTTs that ran the cables.
Yes.
Now they don't.
That's right.
There's been this big transfer of power that has taken place under their noses without their having foreseen it.
Abby stops in front of a stall that sells LEDs in all manner of bubblegum colors, packed into tiny boxes like ripe tropical fruits in crates, and standing up from cubes of foam like psychedelic mushrooms. He is making big transfer of power gestures with his hands, but to Randy's increasingly warped mind, this looks like a man moving heavy gold bars from one pile to another. Across the aisle, they are being stared at by the dead eyes of 100 miniature video cameras. Abby continues.
And as we've talked about many times, there are many reasons why different governments might want to control the flow of information. China might want to institute political censorship, whereas the U.S. might want to regulate electronic cash transfers so that they can keep collecting taxes. In the old days, they could ultimately do this insofar as they owned the cables.
But now they can't, Randy says.
Now they can't. And this change happened very fast, or at least it looked fast to government, with its retarded intellectual metabolism. And now they are way behind the curve, and scared and pissed off, and starting to lash out.
They are?
They are.
In what way are they lashing out?
A toggle switch merchant snaps a rag over rows and columns of stainless steel merchandise. The tip of the rag breaks the sound barrier and generates a tiny sonic pop that blasts a dust mote from the top of a switch. Everyone is politely ignoring them.
Do you have any idea what downtime on a state-of-the-art cable costs nowadays?
Of course I do, Randy says. It could be hundreds of thousands of dollars a minute.
That's right. And it takes at least a couple of days to repair a broken cable. A couple of days. A single break in a cable can cost the companies that own it tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars in lost revenue.
But that hasn't been that much of an issue, Randy says. The cables are plowed in so deeply now, they're only exposed in the deep ocean.
Yes. Where only an entity with the naval resources of a major government could sever them.
Oh, shit.
This is the new balance of power, Randy.
You can't seriously be telling me that governments are threatening to...
The Chinese have already done it. They cut an older cable, first-generation optical fiber, joining Korea to Nippon. The cable wasn't that important. They only did it as a warning shot. And what's the rule of thumb about governments cutting submarine cables?
That is like nuclear war, Randy says. Easy to start, devastating in its results, so no one does it.
But if the Chinese have cut a cable, then other governments with a vested interest in throttling information flow can say, hey, the Chinese did it. We need to show that we can retaliate in kind.
Is that actually happening?
No, Abby says.
They've stopped in front of the largest display of needle-nose pliers Randy has ever seen.
It's all posturing. It's not aimed at other governments so much as at the entrepreneurs who own and operate the new cables.
Light dawns in Randy's mind.
Such as the dentist.
The dentist has put more money into privately financed submarine cables than just about anyone. He has a minority stake in that cable that the Chinese cut between Korea and Nippon, so he's trapped like a rat. He has no choice, no choice at all, other than to do as he's told.
And who's giving the orders?
I'm sure that the Chinese are very big in this. They don't have any internal checks and balances in their government, so they are most prone to do something that is grossly irregular like this.
And they obviously have the most to lose from unfettered information flow.
Yeah. But I'm just cynical enough to suspect that a whole lot of other governments are right behind them.
If that's true, Randy says, then everything is completely fucked.
Sooner or later, a cable cutting war is going to break out. All the cables will get chopped through. End of story.
The world doesn't work that way anymore, Randy. Governments get together and negotiate, like they did in Brussels just after Christmas. They come up with agreements. War does not break out. Usually.
So there's an agreement in place?
Abby shrugs.
As best as I can make out, a balance of power has been struck between the people who own navies, i.e. the people who have the ability to cut cables with impunity, and the people who own and operate cables. Each side is afraid of what the other can do to it. So they have come to a genteel understanding. The bureaucratic incarnation of it is IDTRO.
And the dentist is in on it.
Precisely.
So maybe the Ordo siege really was ultimately directed by the government.
I very much doubt that Comstock ordered it, Abby says. I think it was the dentist demonstrating his loyalty.
How about the crypt? Is the Sultan party to this understanding? Abby shrugs.
Pragasu isn't saying much. I told him what I have just told you. I laid out my theory of what is going on. He looked tolerantly amused. He did not confirm or deny. But he did give me cause to believe that the crypt is still going to be up and running on schedule.
See, I find that hard to believe, Randy says. It seems like the crypt is their worst nightmare.
Whose worst nightmare?
Any government that needs to collect taxes.
Randy, governments will always find ways to collect taxes. If worst comes to worst, the IRS can just base everything on property taxes. You can't hide real estate in cyberspace. But keep in mind that the U.S. government is only a part of this thing. The Chinese are very big in it, too.
Wing,
Randy blurts. He and Avi cringe and look around them. The Pasukan otaku don't care. A man selling rainbow-colored wire ribbons eyes them with polite curiosity, then looks away. They move out of the bazaar and onto the sidewalk. It has started to rain. A dozen nearly identical young women in miniskirts and high heels march in wedge formation down the center of the street, sporting huge umbrellas blazoned with the face of a video game character.
"Wing's digging for gold in Boondock," Randy says. "He thinks he knows where Golgotha is. If he finds it, he'll need a really special kind of bank."
"He's not the only guy in the world who needs a special bank," Avi says. "Over the years, Switzerland has done a hell of a lot of business with governments, or people connected with governments. Why didn't Hitler invade Switzerland? Because the Nazis couldn't have done without it. So the crypt definitely fills a niche."
"Okay," Randy says. "So the crypt will be allowed to remain in existence."
"It has to. The world needs it," Avi says. "And we'll need it when we dig up Golgotha."
Suddenly Avi's got an impish look on his face. He looks to have shed about 10 years of age. This gets a belly laugh out of Randy, the first time he's really laughed in a couple of months. His mood has gone through some seismic shift all of a sudden. The whole world looks different to him.
"It's not enough to know where it is. Enoch Root says that these hoards were buried deep in mines down in the hard rock, so we're not going to get that gold out without launching a pretty major engineering project."
"Why do you think I'm in Tokyo?" Avi says. "Come on, let's get back to the hotel."
While Avi's checking in, Randy collects his messages from the front desk and finds a FedEx envelope waiting for him. If it was tampered with en route, the tamperers did a good job of covering their traces. It contains a hand-enciphered message from Enoch Root, who evidently has figured out some way to get himself sprung from the clink with his scruples intact. It is several lines of seemingly random block letters, in groups of 5. Randy has been carrying around a deck of cards ever since he got sprung from jail, the prearranged key that will decipher this message. The prospect of several hours of solitaire seems a lot less inviting in Tokyo than it did in prison, and he knows it will take that long to decipher a message as long as this one. But he's already programmed his laptop to play solitaire according to Enoch's rules, and he's already punched in the key that is embodied in the deck that Enoch gave him and stored it on a floppy disk that he keeps rubber-banded to the deck in his pocket. So he and Avi go up to Avi's room, pausing along the way to collect Randy's laptop, and while Avi sorts through his messages, Randy types in the ciphertext and gets it deciphered.
"Enoch's message says that the land above Golgotha is owned by the church," Randy mutters. "But in order to reach it, we have to travel across land owned by Wing and by some Filipinos."
Avi doesn't appear to hear him. He's fixated on a message slip.
"What's up?" Randy asks.
"A little change of plans for tonight. I hope you have a really good suit with you."
"I didn't know we had plans for tonight."
"We were going to meet with Goto Furudenendu," Avi says. "I sort of figured that they were the right guys to approach about digging a big hole in the ground."
"I'm with you," Randy says. "What's the change in plan?"
"The old man is coming down from his retreat in Hokkaido. He wants to buy us dinner."
"What old man?"
"The founder of the company, Goto Furudenendu's father," Avi says. "Protege of Douglas MacArthur. Multi-multi-multi-millionaire. Golf partner and confidant of prime ministers. An old guy by the name of Goto Dengo."
Project X. It is early in April of the year 1945. A middle-aged Nipponese widow feels the earth turning over and scurries out of her paper house, fearing a tembler. Her house is on the island of Kyushu, near the sea. She gazes out over the ocean and sees a black ship on the horizon, steaming out of a rising sun of its own making. For when its guns go off, the entire vessel is shrouded in red fire for a moment. She hopes that the Yamato, the world's greatest battleship, which steamed away over that horizon a few days ago, has returned victorious and is firing its guns in celebration. But this is an American battleship, and it is dropping shells into the port that the Yamato just left, making the Earth's bowels heave as if it were preparing to throw up. Until this moment, the Nipponese woman has been convinced that the armed forces of her nation were crushing the Americans, the British, the Dutch, and the Chinese at every turn. This apparition must be some kind of bizarre suicide raid. But the black ship stays there all day long, heaving ton after ton of dynamite into sacred soil. No airplanes come out to bomb it, no ships to shell it, not even a submarine to torpedo it. In a shocking display of bad form, Patton has lunged across the Rhine ahead of schedule, to the irritation of Montgomery, who has been making laborious plans and preparations to do it first. The German submarine, U-234, is in the North Atlantic, headed for the Cape of Good Hope, carrying 10 containers holding 1,200 pounds of uranium oxide. The uranium is bound for Tokyo, where it will be used in some experiments, still in a preliminary phase, towards the construction of a new and extremely powerful explosive device. General Curtis LeMay's Air Force has spent much of the last month flying dangerously low over Nipponese cities, showering them with incendiary devices. A quarter of Tokyo has been leveled. 83,000 people died there. And this does not count the similar raids on Nagoya, Osaka, and Kobe. The night after the Osaka raid, some Marines raised a flag on Iwo Jima, and they put a picture of it in all the papers. Within the last few days, the Red Army, now the most terrible force on Earth, has taken Vienna and the oil fields of Hungary, and the Soviets have declared that their neutrality pact with Nippon will be allowed to expire rather than being renewed. Okinawa has just been invaded. The fighting is the worst ever. The invasion is supported by a vast fleet against which the Nipponese have launched everything they have. The Yamato came after them, her 18-inch guns at the ready, carrying only enough fuel for a one-way voyage. But the cryptanalysts of the U.S. Navy intercepted and decrypted her orders, and the great ship was sent to the bottom with 2,500 men. The Nipponese have launched the first of their floating chrysanthemum assaults against the invasion fleet. Clouds of kamikaze planes, human bombs, human torpedoes, speedboats packed with explosives. To the irritation and bafflement of the German high command, the Nipponese government has sent a message to them, requesting that, in the event that all of Germany's European naval bases are lost, the Kriegsmarine should be given orders to continue operating with the Nipponese in the Far East. The message is encrypted in indigo. It is duly intercepted and read by the Allies. In the United Kingdom, Dr. Alan Matheson Turing, considering the war to be effectively finished, has long since turned his attentions away from the problem of voice encryption and into the creation of thinking machines. For about 10 months, ever since the finished Colossus Mark II was delivered to Bletchley Park, he has had the opportunity to work with a truly programmable computing machine. Alan invented these machines long before one was ever built, and has never needed hands-on experience in order to think about them. But his experiences with Colossus Mark II have helped him to solidify some ideas of how the next machine ought to be designed. He thinks of it as a post-war machine, but that's only because he's in Europe and hasn't been concerned with the problem of conquering Nippon as much as Waterhouse has. "I've been working on bury and disinter," says a voice, coming out of small holes in a bake-like headset clamped over Waterhouse's head. The voice is oddly distorted, nearly obscured by white noise and a maddening buzz. "Please say it again," Lawrence says, pressing the phones against his ear. "Bury and disinter," says the voice. "They are, sets of instructions for the machine to execute, to carry out certain algorithms. They are programs."
"Right, sorry. I just wasn't able to hear you the first time." "Yes, I've been working on them too," Waterhouse says.
"The next machine will have a memory storage system, Lawrence, in the form of sound waves traveling down a cylinder filled with mercury. We stole the idea from John Wilkins, founder of the Royal Society, who came up with it 300 years ago, except he was going to use air instead of quicksilver. Excuse me, Lawrence, did you say you had been working on them?"
"I did the same thing with tubes. Valves, as you would call them."
"Well, that's all well and good for you Yanks," Alan says. I suppose if you are infinitely rich, you can make a buried disinter system out of steam locomotives or something and retain a staff of thousands to run around squirting oil on the squeaky bits.
The Mercury line is a good idea, Waterhouse admits. Very resourceful.
Have you actually gotten bury and disinter to work with valves?
Yes. My disinter works better than our shovel expeditions, Lawrence says. Did you ever find those silver bars you buried?
No, Alan says absently. They are lost. Lost in the noise of the world.
You know, that was a Turing test I just gave you, Lawrence says.
Beg pardon?
This damn machine screws up your voice so bad I can't tell you from Winston Churchill, Lawrence says. So the only way I can verify it's you is by getting it to say things that only Alan Turing could say.
He hears Alan's sharp, high-pitched laugh at the other end of the line.
It's him, all right.
This Project X thing really is appalling, Alan says. Delilah is infinitely superior. I wish you could see it for yourself, or hear it.
Alan is in London, in a command bunker somewhere. Lawrence is in Manila Bay, on the Rock, the island of Corregidor. They are joined by a thread of copper that goes all the way around the world. There are many such threads traversing the floors of the world's oceans now, but only a few special ones go to rooms like this. The rooms are in Washington, London, Melbourne, and now Corregidor. Lawrence looks through a thick glass window into the engineer's booth, where a phonograph record is playing on the world's most precise and expensive turntable. This is, likewise, the most valuable record ever turned out. It is filled with what is intended to be perfectly random white noise. The noise is electronically combined with the sound of Lawrence's voice before it is sent down the wire. Once it gets to London, the noise, which is being read off an identical phonograph record there, is subtracted from his voice and the result sent into Alan Turing's headphones. It all depends on the two phonographs being perfectly synchronized. The only way to synchronize them is to transmit that maddening buzzing noise, a carrier wave, along with the voice signal. If all goes well, the opposite phonograph player can lock onto the buzz and spin its wax in lockstep. The phonograph record is, in other words, a one-time pad. Somewhere in New York, in the bowels of Bell Labs, behind a locked and guarded door stenciled Project X, technicians are turning out more of these things. The very latest chart-topping white noise. They stamp out a few copies, dispatch them by courier to the Project X sites around the globe, then destroy the originals. They would not be having this conversation at all, except that a couple of years ago, Alan went to Greenwich Village and worked at Bell Labs for a few months, while Lawrence was on Tagum. His Majesty's government sent him there to evaluate this Project X thing and let them know whether it was truly secure. Alan decided that it was, then went back home and began working on a much better one, called Delilah.
What the hell does this have to do with dead Chinese abacus slaves?
To Lawrence, staring through the window at the spinning white noise disc, the connection could hardly be clearer. He says,
"Last I spoke to you, you were working on generating random noise for Delilah."
"Yes,"
Alan says absently.
"That was a long time ago, and that whole project has been buried in his memory storage system. It will take him a minute or two to disinter it."
"What sorts of algorithms did you consider to create that noise?"
There is another 5-second pause. Then Alan launches into a disquisition about mathematical functions for generating pseudo-random number sequences. Alan had a good British boarding school education, and his utterances tend to be well-structured, with outline form, topic sentences, the whole bit. Pseudo-random numbers. 1. Caveat. They aren't really random, of course. They just look that way, and that's why the pseudo. 2. Overview of the problem. A. It seems as if it should be easy. B. Actually, it turns out to be really hard. C. Consequences of failure. Germans decrypt our secret messages, millions die, humanity is enslaved, world plunged into an eternal dark age. D. How can you tell if a series of numbers is random? 1, 2, 3, and so on. A list of different statistical tests for randomness, the advantages and disadvantages of each. 3. a bunch of stuff that I, Alan Turing, tried. A, B, C, and so on. A list of different mathematical functions that Alan used to generate random numbers, how almost all of them failed abjectly. Alan's initial confidence is replaced by surprise, then exasperation, then despair, and finally, by guarded confidence, as he at last finds some techniques that work. 4. Conclusions. A. It's harder than it looks. B. It's not for the unwary. C. It can be done if you keep your wits about you. D. In retrospect, a surprisingly interesting mathematical problem deserving of further research. When Alan finishes with this perfectly structured whirlwind tour of the surprising world of pseudo-randomness, Lawrence says, "How about zeta functions?"
"Didn't even consider those,"
Alan says. Lawrence's mouth drops open. He can see his own semi-transparent reflection in the window, superimposed on the spinning phonograph, and he sees that he has got a sort of mildly outraged look on his face. There must be something conspicuously non-random about the output of the zeta function, something so obvious to Alan that he dismissed it out of hand. But Lawrence has never seen any such thing. He knows that Alan is smarter than he is, but he's not used to being so desperately far behind him.
Why not?
He finally stammers.
"Because of Rudy,"
Alan thunders.
"You and I and Rudy all worked on that damn machine at Princeton. Rudy knows that you and I have the knowledge to build such a device, so it is the first thing that he would assume we would use."
"Ah," Lawrence sighs.
"But leaving that aside, the zeta function might still be a good way of doing it."
"It might," Alan says guardedly. "But I have not investigated it. You're not thinking of using it, are you?"
Lawrence tells Alan about the abaci. Even through the noise and the buzz, he can tell that Alan is thunderstruck. There is a pause while the technicians at each end flip over their phonograph records. When the connection is reestablished, Alan's still very excited.
"Let me tell you something more," Lawrence says.
"Yes, go ahead."
"You know that the Nipponese use a plethora of different codes, and we still have only broken some of them."
"Yes."
"There is an unbroken cipher system that Central Bureau calls Arethusa. It's incredibly rare. Only 30-some Arethusa messages have ever been intercepted."
"Some company code?" Alan asks.
This is a good guess. Each major Nipponese corporation had its own code system before the war, and much effort has gone into stealing codebooks for, and otherwise breaking, the Mitsubishi code, to name one example.
"We can't figure out the sources and destinations of Arethusa messages," Lawrence continues, "because they use a unique site code system. We can only guess at their origins by using Huffduff, and Huffduff tells us that most of the Arethusa messages have originated from submarines. Possibly just a single submarine, plying the route between Europe and Southeast Asia. We have also seen them from Sweden, from London, Buenos Aires, and Manila."
"Buenos Aires? Sweden?"
"Yes. And so, Alan, I took an interest in Arethusa."
"Well, I don't blame you."
"The message format matches that of Azure Pufferfish."
"Rudy's system?"
"Yes."
"Nice work on that, by the way."
"Well, thank you, Alan. As you must have heard by now, it is based on zeta functions, which you did not even consider using for Delilah because you were afraid Rudy would think of it. And this raises the question of whether Rudy intended us to break Azure Pufferfish all along."
"Yes, it does. But why would he want us to?"
"I have no idea. The old Azure Pufferfish messages may contain some clues. I'm having my digital computer generate retroactive one-time paths so that I can decrypt those messages and read them."
"Well then, I shall have Colossus do the same.
It is busy just now," Alan says,
"working on fish decrypts. But I don't think Hitler has much longer to go. When he is finished, I can probably get down to Bletchley and decrypt those messages."
"I'm also working on Arethusa," Lauren says. "I'm guessing it all has something to do with gold."
"Why do you say that?"
Alan says. But at this point, the tone arm of the phonograph reaches the end of its spiral groove and lifts off the record. Time's up. Bell Labs and the might of the Allied governments did not install the Project X network so that mathematicians could indulge in endless chit-chat about obscure functions. Landfall. The sailing ship Gertrude wheezes into the cove shortly after sunrise, and Bischoff cannot help but laugh. Barnacles have grown so thick around her hull that the hull itself, he supposes, could be removed entirely, and the shell of barnacles could be outfitted with a mast and canvas and sailed to Tahiti. 100-yard-long skein of seaweed, rooted in those barnacles, trails behind her, making a long, greasy disturbance in her wake. Her mast has evidently been snapped off at least once. It has been replaced by a rude jury-rigged thing, a tree trunk that has received some attention from a draw knife but still has bark adhering to it in places, and long dribbles of golden sap like wax trails on a candle, themselves streaked with sea salt. Her sails are nearly black with dirt and mildew and rudely patched here and there with fat black stitches, like the flesh of Frankenstein's monster. The men on board are scarcely in better shape. They do not even bother to drop anchor. They just run Gertrude aground on a coral head at the entrance to the cove and call it a day. Most of Bischoff's crew has gathered on the top of V. Million, the rocket submarine. They think it's the most hilarious thing they've ever seen. But when the men on Gertrude climb into a dinghy and begin rowing towards them, Bischoff's men remember their manners and stand at attention and salute. Bischoff tries to recognize them as they row closer. It takes a while. There are five in all. Otto has lost his potbelly and gone much grayer. Rudy is a completely different man. He has long flowing hair ponytailed down his back and a surprisingly thick Viking-like beard, and he appears to have lost his left eye somewhere along the way because he's got an actual black patch over it.
"My God," Bischoff says, "pirates!"
The other three men he has never seen before, a Negro with dreadlocks, a brown-skinned Indian-looking fellow, and a red-headed European. Rudy is watching a stingray furling and unfurling its meaty wings 10 meters straight down.
"The clarity of the water is exquisite," he remarks.
"When the Catalinas come for us, Rudy, then you will long for the old northern murk," Bischoff says.
Rudolf von Heckelhaber swings his one eye around to bear on Bischoff and allows just a trace of amusement to show on his face.
"Permission to come aboard, Captain?" Rudy asks. "Granted with pleasure," Bischoff says.
The dinghy has come alongside the round hull of the submarine, and Bischoff's crew unrolls a rope ladder to them.
"Welcome to the V. Million. I have heard of the V-1 and the V-2, but we could not guess how many other V-weapons Hitler might have invented, and so we chose a very, very large number,"
Bischoff says proudly.
"But, Gunther, you know what the V stands for. Vergeltungswaffen," Bischoff says. "Well, you're not thinking about it hard enough, Rudy."
Otto's puzzled, and being puzzled makes him angry.
"Vergeltung means revenge, doesn't it?"
"But it can also mean to pay someone back, to compensate them, to reward them," says Rudy. "Even to bless them. I like it very much, Gunther."
"Admiral Bischoff to you," Gunther returns.
"You are the supreme commander of the V. Million? There is no one above you?"
Bischoff clicks his heels together sharply and holds out his right arm.
"Heil Dönitz!"
he shouts.
"What the hell are you talking about?"
asks Otto.
"Haven't you been reading the papers? Hitler killed himself yesterday, in Berlin. The new Führer is my personal friend, Karl Dönitz."
"Is he part of the conspiracy, too?"
Otto mutters.
"I thought my dear mentor and protector Hermann Göring was going to be Hitler's successor,"
Rudy says, sounding almost crestfallen.
"He is down in the south somewhere," Bischoff says, "on a diet. Just before Hitler took cyanide, he ordered the SS to arrest that fat bastard."
"But in all seriousness, Gunther, when you boarded this U-boat in Sweden, it was called something else, and there were some Nazis on board, yes?"
asks Rudy.
"I had completely forgotten about them."
Bischoff cups his hands around his mouth and shouts down the hatch in the top of the sleek, rounded-off conning tower.
"Has anyone seen our Nazis?"
The command echoes down the length of the U-boat from sailor to sailor.
"Nazis? Nazis? Nazis?"
But somewhere it turns into,
"Nine! Nine! Nine!"
and echoes back up the conning tower and out the hatch. Rudy climbs up V. Million's smooth hull on bare feet.
"Ah, do you have any citrus fruit?"
He smiles, showing magenta craters in his gums where teeth might be expected.
"Get the calamansis,"
Bischoff says to one of his mates.
"Rudy, for you we have the Filipino miniature limes, great piles of them, with more vitamin C than you could ever want."
"I doubt that," Rudy says.
Otto just looks at Bischoff reproachfully, holding him personally responsible for having been thrown together with these four other men for all of 1944 and the first 4 months of 1945. Finally, he speaks.
"Is that son of a bitch Shafto here?"
"That son of a bitch Shafto is dead," Bischoff says. Otto averts his glare and nods his head.
"I take it you received my letter from Buenos Aires?"
asks Rudy von Heckelhaber.
"Mr. G. Bishop, General Delivery, Manila, the Philippines," Bischoff recites.
"Of course I did, my friend, or else we would not have known where to meet you. I picked it up when I went into town to renew my acquaintance with Enoch Root."
"He made it?"
"He made it."
"How did Shafto die?"
"Gloriously, of course,"
Bischoff says.
"And there is other news from Julieta. The conspiracy has a son. Congratulations, Otto, you are a granduncle."
This actually elicits a smile, albeit black and gappy, from Otto.
"What's his name?"
"Gunter Enoch Bobby Kivistik. 8 pounds, 3 ounces. Superb for a wartime baby."
There is handshaking all around. Rudy, ever debonair, produces some Honduran cigars to mark the occasion. He and Otto stand in the sun and smoke cigars and drink calamansi juice.
"We have been waiting here for 3 weeks, Bischoff says. "What kept you?"
Otto spits out something that is pretty bad-looking.
"I am sorry that you have had to spend 3 weeks tanning yourselves on the beach while we have been sailing this tub of shit across the Pacific."
"We were dismasted and lost 3 men, and my left eye and 2 of Otto's fingers, and a few other items going around Cape Horn," Rudy says apologetically. "Our cigars got a little wet. It played havoc with our schedule."
"No matter," Bischoff says. "The gold isn't going anywhere."
"Do we know where it is?"
"Not exactly, but we have found one who does."
"Clearly we have much to discuss," Rudy says.
"But I have to die first, preferably on a soft bed."
"Fine," Bischoff says.
"Is there anything that needs to be removed from Gertrude before we cut her throat and let her barnacles pull her to the bottom?"
"Sink the bitch now, please,"
Otto says.
"I will even stay up here and watch."
"First, you must remove 5 crates marked Property of the Reichsmarschall," Rudy says. "Sail down in the bilge. We use them as ballast."
Otto looks startled and scratches his beard in wonderment.
"I forgot those were down there."
The year-and-a-half-old memory is slowly resolving in his mind's eye.
"It took a whole day to load them in. I wanted to kill you. My back still aches from it."
Bischoff says,
"Rudy, you made off with Goering's pornography collection?"
"I wouldn't like his kind of pornography,"
Rudy answers evenly.
"These are cultural treasures. Loot."
"They will have been ruined by bilge water."
"It's all gold. Sheets of gold foil with holes in it. Impervious."
"Rudy, we are supposed to be exporting gold from the Philippines, not importing it."
"Don't worry. I shall export it again one day."
"By that time, we'll have money to hire stevedores, so poor Otto won't have to put his back out again."
"We won't need stevedores," Rudy says. "When I export what is on those sheets, I'll do it on wires."
They all stand there on the deck of V. Million in the tropical cove, watching the sun set and the flying fish leap and hearing birds and insects cry and buzz from the flowering jungle all around. Bischoff's trying to imagine wires strung from here to Los Angeles and sheets of gold foil sliding down them. It doesn't really work.
"Come below, Rudy," he says. "We need to get some vitamin C into you."
Goto-sama. Avi meets Randy in the hotel lobby. He has burdened himself with a square, old-fashioned briefcase that pulls his slender frame to one side, giving him the asymptotic curve of a sapling in a steady wind. He and Randy take a taxi to some other part of Tokyo. Randy cannot begin to fathom how the city is laid out. Enter the lobby of a skyscraper and take an elevator up far enough that Randy's ears pop. When the doors slide open, a maitre d' is standing right there anticipating them with a radiant smile and a bow. He leads them into a foyer where four men wait. A couple of younger minions, Goto Furundanendu, and an elderly gentleman. Randy was expecting one of these gracile, translucent Nipponese seniors, but Goto Dengo is a blocky fellow with a white buzz cut, somewhat hunched and collapsed with age, which only goes to make him seem more compact and solid. At first blush, he seems more like a retired village blacksmith, or perhaps a master sergeant in a daimyo's army, than a business executive, and yet within 5 or 10 seconds, this impression is swallowed up by a good suit, good manners, and Randy's knowledge of who he really is. He's the only guy in the place who isn't grinning from ear to ear. Apparently, when you reach a certain age, you are allowed to get away with staring tunnels through other people's skulls. In the manner of many old people, he looks vaguely startled that they have actually shown up. Still, he levers himself up on a big, gnarled cane and shakes their hands firmly. His son, Furudanendu, proffers a hand to help him to his feet, and he shrugs it off with a glare of mock outrage. This transaction looks pretty well practiced. There's a brief exchange of small talk that goes right over Randy's head. Then the two minions peel off like a fighter escort no longer needed, and the maitre d' leads Randy, Avi, and Goto Pere Fil across a totally empty restaurant, 20 or 30 tables set with white linen and crystal, to a corner table where waiters stand at attention to pull their chairs back. This building is of the sheer walls of solid glass school of architecture, and so the windows go floor to ceiling, providing, through a bead curtain of raindrops, a view of nighttime Tokyo that stretches over the horizon. Menus are handed out, printed in French only. Randy and Avi get the girl menus, with no prices. Goto Dengo gets the wine list and pores over it for a good 10 minutes before grudgingly selecting a white from California and a red from Burgundy. Meanwhile, Furundanendu is leading them in exceedingly pleasant small talk about the crypt. Randy can't stop looking at Tokyo on the one hand and the empty restaurant on the other. It's like this setting was picked specifically to remind them that the Nipponese economy has been on the skids for the last several years, a situation that the Asian currency crisis has only worsened. He half expects to see executives dropping past the window. Avi ventures to ask about various tunnels and other stupefyingly vast engineering projects that he happens to have noticed around Tokyo, and whether Goto Engineering has anything to do with them. This at least gets the patriarch to glance up momentarily from his wine list, but the son handles the inquiries, allowing as how, yes, their company did play a small part in those endeavors. Randy figures that it's not the easiest thing in the world to engage a personal friend of the late General of the Army Douglas MacArthur in polite chit-chat. It's not like you can ask him if he caught the latest episode of Star Trek, more time-space anomalies. All they can really do is cling to Furudanendu and let him take the lead. Goto Dengo clears his throat like the engine of a major piece of earth-moving equipment rumbling to life and recommends the Kobe beef. The sommelier comes around with the wines, and Goto Dengo interrogates him in a mixture of Nipponese and French for a while, until a film of sweat has broken out on the sommelier's brow. He samples the wines very carefully. The tension is explosive as he swirls them around in his mouth, staring off into the distance. The sommelier seems genuinely startled, not to mention relieved, when he accepts both of them. The subtext here would seem to be that hosting a really first-class dinner is a not insignificant management challenge, and that Goto Dengo should not be bothered with social chatter while he is coping with these responsibilities. At this point, Randy's paranoia finally kicks in. Is it possible that Goto-sama bought the whole restaurant out for the evening just to get a little privacy? Were the two minions just aides with unusually bulky briefcases, or were they security, sweeping the place for surveillance devices? Again, subtext-wise, the message seems to be that Randy and Abby are not to worry their pretty young little heads about these things. Goto Dango is seated underneath a can light in the ceiling. His hair stands perpendicularly out from his head, a bristling stand of normal vectors radiating halogenically. He has a formidable number of scars on his face and his hands, and Randy suddenly realizes that he must have been in the war, which should have been perfectly obvious considering his age. Goto Dango inquires about how Randy and Avi got into their current lines of work and how they formed their partnership. This is a reasonable question, but it forces them to explain the entire concept of fantasy role-playing games. If Randy had known this would happen, he would have thrown himself bodily through a window instead of taking a seat. But Goto Dango takes it pretty calmly and instantly cross-correlates it to late-breaking developments in the Nipponese game industry, which has been doing this gradual paradigm shift from arcade to role-playing games with actual narratives. By the time he's finished, he makes them feel not like lightweight nerds, but like visionary geniuses who were 10 years ahead of their time. This more or less obligates Avi, who is taking conversational point, to ask Goto Dango how he got into his line of work. Both of the Gotos try to laugh it off, as if how could a couple of young American visionary Dungeons and Dragons pioneers possibly be interested in something as trivial as how Goto Dango single-handedly rebuilt post-war Nippon? But after Avi displays a bit of persistence, the patriarch finally shrugs and says something about how his pop was in the mining racket, and so he's always had a certain knack for digging holes in the ground. His English started out minimal, and is getting better and better as the evening proceeds, as if he is slowly dusting off substantial banks of memory and processing power, nursing them online like tube amplifiers. Dinner arrives, and so everyone has to eat for a bit, and to thank Goto-sama for his excellent recommendation. Avi gets a bit reckless and asks the old man if he might regale them with some reminiscences about Douglas MacArthur. He grins, as if some secret has been ferreted out of him, and says,
"I met the general in the Philippines."
Just like that, he's jiu-jitsued the topic of conversation around to what everyone actually wants to talk about. Randy's pulse and respiration ratchet up by a good 25%, and all of his senses become more acute, almost as if his ears have popped again and he loses his appetite. Everyone else seems to be sitting up a bit straighter, too, shifting in their chairs slightly. "Did you spend much time in that country?" Avi asks.
"Oh, yes, much time. 100 years,
says Goto Dango, with a rather frosty grin. He pauses, giving everyone a chance to get good and uneasy, and then continues.
"My son tells me that you want to dig a grave there."
"A hole," Randy ventures, after much uncomfortableness.
"Excuse me, my English is rusty," says Goto Dango,
none too convincingly. Abby says,
"What we have in mind would be a major excavation by our standards, but probably not by yours."
Goto Dango chuckles.
"That all depends on the circumstances. Permits, transportation issues. The crypt was a big excavation, but it was easy because the Sultan was supporting it."
"I must emphasize that the work we are considering is still in a very early planning phase," Avi says. "I regret to say I can't give you good information about the logistical issues."
Goto Dango comes this close to rolling his eyes.
"I understand,"
he says, with a dismissive wave of the hand.
"We will not talk about these things this evening."
This produces a really awkward pause while Randy and Avi ask themselves,
What the hell are we going to talk about then?
Very well,
Abby says, sort of weakly lobbing the ball back in Gododengo's general direction. Furudanendu steps in.
There are many people who dig holes in the Philippines,
he explains with a big knowing wink. Ah, Randy says, I have met some of the people you are talking about. This produces a general outburst of laughter around the table, which is nonetheless sincere for being tense.
You understand, then, says Furudanendu, that we would have to study a joint venture very carefully.
Even Randy easily translates this to, we will participate in your Looney Tunes treasure hunt when hell freezes over.
Please,
Randy says. Goto Engineering is a distinguished company, top of the line. You have much better things to do than to gamble on joint ventures. We would never propose such a thing. We would be able to pay for your services up front.
Ah.
The Gotos look at each other significantly.
You have a new investor.
We know you are broke. Avi grins.
We have new resources.
This leaves the Gotos nonplussed.
If I may,
Avi says. He heaves his briefcase up off the floor and onto his lap, flips the latches open, and reaches into it with both hands. Then he performs a maneuver that, in a bodybuilding gym, would be called a barbell curl, and lifts a brick of solid gold into the light. The faces of Gododengo and Godofurundanendu are transmuted to stone. Avi holds the bar up for a few moments, then lowers it back into his briefcase. Eventually, Furudanendu scoots his chair back a couple of centimeters and rotates it slightly toward his father, basically excusing himself from the conversation. Gododengo eats dinner and drinks wine calmly and silently for a very, very long 15 or 20 minutes. Finally, he looks across the table at Randy and says,
Where do you want to dig?
The site is in mountains south of Laguna de Bay.
Yes, you already told my son that. But that is a large area of boondocks. Many holes have been dug there, all worthless.
We have better information.
Some old Filipino has sold you his memories?
Better than that, Randy says. We have a latitude and longitude.
To what degree of precision?
Tenths of a second. This occasions another pause. Furudanendu tries to say something in Nipponese, but his father cuts him off gruffly. Gododengo finishes his dinner and crosses his fork and knife on the plate. A waiter's there 5 seconds later to clear the table. Gododengo says something to him that sends him fleeing back into the kitchen. They have essentially a whole floor of the skyscraper to themselves now. Gododengo utters something to his son, who produces a fountain pen and 2 business cards. Furudanendu hands the pen and 1 card to his father and the other card to Randy.
Let's play a little game,
Gododengo says.
You have a pen?
Yes, Randy says.
I am going to write down a latitude and longitude,
Gododengo says.
But only the seconds portion. No degrees and no minutes, only the seconds part. You understand?
Yes.
The information is useless by itself. You agree?
Yes.
Then there is no risk for you to write down the same.
It's true.
Then we will exchange cards. Agreed?
I agree.
Very well.
Gododengo starts writing. Randy takes a pen from his pocket and jogs down the seconds and tenths of a second. Latitude, 35.2. Longitude, 59.0. When he's done, Gododengo's looking at him expectantly. Randy holds out his card, numbers facing down, and Gododengo holds out his. They exchange them with the small bow that is obligatory around here. Randy cups Godosama's card in his palm and turns it into the light. It says, 35.2, 59.0. No one says anything for 10 minutes.
It's a measure of how stunned Randy is that he doesn't realize for a long time that Gutto Dango is just as stunned as he is. Avi and Furudanendu are the only people at the table whose minds are still functioning, and they spend the whole time looking at each other uncertainly, neither one really understanding what's going on. Finally, Avi says something that Randy doesn't hear. He nudges Randy firmly and says it again.
I'm going to the lavatory.
Randy watches him go, counts to 10, and says,
Excuse me.
He follows Avi to the men's washroom. Black polished stone, thick white towels, Avi standing there with his arms crossed.
He knows,
Randy says.
I don't believe it.
Randy shrugs.
What can I say?
He knows. If he knows, everyone knows. Our security broke down somewhere along the line.
Everyone doesn't know, Randy says. If everyone knew, all hell would be breaking loose down there, and Enoch would have gotten word to us.
Then how can he know?
Avi,
Randy says.
He must be the one who buried it.
Avi looks outraged.
Are you shitting me?
You have a better theory?
I thought all the people who buried the stuff were killed.
It's fair to say that he's a survivor. Wouldn't you agree?
10 minutes later, they return to the table. Gutto Dango has allowed the restaurant staff back into the room, and dessert menus have been brought out. Weirdly, the old man has gone back into polite chit-chat mode, and Randy gradually figures out that he's trying to work out how the hell Randy knows what he knows. Randy mentions, offhandedly, that his grandfather was a cryptanalyst in Manila in 1945. Gutto Dango sighs, visibly, with relief, and cheers up somewhat. Then it's more completely meaningless chatter until postprandial coffee has been served, at which point the patriarch leans forward to make a point.
Before you sip, look.
Randy and Avi look into their cups. A weirdly glittering layer of scum is floating atop their coffee.
It is gold,
Furudanendu explains. Both of the Gottos laugh.
During the 80s, when Nippon had so much money, this was the fashion. Coffee with gold dust. Now it is out of fashion, too ostentatious. But you go ahead and drink.
Randy and Avi do, a bit nervously. The gold dust coats their tongues, then washes away down their throats.
Tell me what you think,
Gutto Dango demands.
It's stupid, Randy says.
Yes.
Gutto Dango nods solemnly.
It is stupid. So tell me then, why do you want to dig up more of it?